Welcome to Roots and Branches on VOA Music Mix. I'm Catherine Cole in Washington, and I am very happy to welcome Rebecca Lobey back to the Roots studio. Rebecca's CD is called Circus Heart. Get us started with a song, please.
All the men that I love can never sleep. They stay up with their demons like they're tending sheep, moaning like wind, whipping the hills, rattling bones against a bottle of pills. I tried to stay awake so I could referee, but eyelids get so heavy when you lecture me. The natural world, the state of your art, baby. Open your mouth, I wanna jump in your heart. Love me tonight. Under the velvety light of a moon that knows better than asking me whether it's right. All the women I'm afraid of are counting grays, like seconds till the new year of their glory days, carefully concealing their busted parts, trying to keep their eyes off of my circus heart. It's swollen to the size of a county fair, off the coast in Nova Scotia, baby, meet me there. I'll be the one in mud boots and braids, biding my time till I hear you say, love me tonight. Under the velvety light of a moon that knows better than asking me whether it's right to love me tonight. All the men that I love can never sleep. They tell me over coffee that it's bittersweet, keeping the hours of scoundrels and mice. Baby, relax, tell me you might love me tonight. Under the velvety light of a moon whether it's right to love me tonight, to love me tonight.
That must be the title track to Rebecca Lobey's new CD, Circus Heart. And while you get yourself settled down, I'm going to just tell you I love that. Keeping the hours of scoundrels and mice. Where did that come from? I love that.
Specifically, I feel like I've known several men in my life who sort of have insomnia / hypochondria and like to just keep themselves up all night, torturing themselves all day long. They're chugging espresso and just talking about how hard their lives are.
Right.
And I guess it's kind of where that song came from.
Are you somebody who's always watching? I mean, do we have to watch out when we're around you?
I had a good friend in Atlanta tell me that if I don't stop writing songs about the dumb stuff my friends do, they're going to stop telling me about it.
But if you don't do that, what are you going to write about?
Exactly. I mean, my love life certainly isn't interesting.
I mean, never interesting as other people. That's the thing. Other people are always more interesting than we are.
You're absolutely right.
Aren't they? Mm-hmm. I mean, I am a people watcher. Are you an inveterate people watcher?
Absolutely.
You must love all this traveling that you have to do then.
You know, that's my favorite part about, I travel so much. I play, 150, 200 shows a year. And last year I performed in 35 states of the U.S. And it's just so amazing getting to see so much of the country, but also getting to meet so many people. And what it's done for me is just affirmed my, it sounds corny because I am a cornball, but this like love of humanity that I have. There are so many just beautiful people with so many compelling stories and who do such touching things for one another at all times. And they're all out there and I get to just interact with more of them than I would if I was staying still and, not out there, out and about in the country.
Rebecca Lobey is here. And in case you weren't with us the last time Rebecca came by, you are originally from Atlanta.
That is true.
Living now in Austin, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Started singing when you were a kid.
Just a wee one. Yep.
And just loved to sing?
You know, my earliest memories, I actually was born here in Arlington, Virginia, and I moved with my family to Atlanta when I was in third grade.
Because when you're that age, they don't let you stay up here by yourself.
Yeah, no, it wasn't my decision. But my earliest memories are walking around on the sidewalks in Arlington and singing, just staring at the sky and singing at the top of my lungs, you know, songs from The Little Mermaid and just whatever Disney movies I could get my hands on. Sesame Street, whatever.
And what did your family think of that?
I think they thought I was loud.
Okay.
I think I took up a lot of sonic space in my household, which is hard to do in a family of four children.
Well, now your brother is here, so we could grill him later.
Yeah, we should bring him in. He's shaking his head.
He doesn't want anything to do with this. So you were one of those kids, and I see them. My niece, who is probably about your age, has got twins now that are almost two. And her daughter has just started singing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
No matter, you can't understand a lot of what she's singing, but I picked out a few things. And a friend of mine's son is now singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. He's three, and he pounds on the piano when he's singing it. And he's kind of close, which is the frightening thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he's close on key and he's close on everything else. But that was it? You heard songs and they had to come out of you?
It's just what I loved to do. I didn't ever think about it. It didn't seem unnatural to me at all. I mean, I also liked to draw. I liked to just create and put things out. But I think that I was not very good at other artistic pursuits. And singing I enjoyed, and I got, you know, some praise for when I was little. So that kind of encouraged that desire and that creative interest more than others, if that makes sense.
So then when you were in the classroom, were you the girl that was always volunteering to get up and sing or do something?
Oh, God, unfortunately, yes, I was.
It was like Glee come to life?
Yeah, in my own little warped mind, yes. I was in my own musical 24/7. Man, you pegged me.
Well, when did you decide that you could also write songs?
You know, when I was in middle school, I think is
so
when
that's 12 years old, 13?
Yeah, like 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. I was taking, you know, English classes and literature classes and writing poetry. And I really got into writing poetry and writing off rhythm, off beat, you know, and I was very, you know, sort of like this little 12-year-old vigilante poet. And I was like, poetry doesn't have to rhyme, man. It's all about expression.
Right,
you know,
right.
Writing,
right.
Just pages and pages of what I felt inside. And then I started playing guitar. And I started, you know, strumming chords and learning how to sing other people's songs. And it was just almost instantly, as soon as I could strum all the way through a song, I started putting my bad teenage poetry to my bad teenage guitar playing, and then the songwriting was born.
I've heard that from a lot of people, though.
Really?
Yeah, that's sort of, all of a sudden they're hit by it.
Yeah.
But you kept going. I mean, you decided to actually not just stop at being a bad teenage poet and guitar player. You kept going, and you cultivated something.
Yeah, you know, when I was in high school, I was 15 years old, and my dad took me to the Monday night open mic at a listening room in Atlanta called Eddie's Attic.
A very famous room.
Yeah, very famous venue. And I remember being really excited because I got to stay out past 10 on a school night. And my dad took me to this open mic, and I saw all of these songwriters, professional people, you know, in their 20s and their 30s.
Big
and they were
people
playing music and guitar and singing original songs. And that, I went home and immediately started writing. And I kept going as often as I could all through the rest of high school to the open mic there. And I feel like that experience sort of shaped my perception of writing and gave me something to strive for and sort of gave me people to look up to.
Were you welcomed?
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
Because sometimes those communities can be a little tough, but maybe being a cute little kid makes it easier to get in than being another 25-year-old.
Well, you know, I wasn't like hanging out at the bar after, you know,
well,
after
I would
the open
not
mic. But I felt like I was heard, you know. I would get up, I would do my two songs, I would have an appreciative audience for that 10 minutes, and then I would get some praise from people in the room and get to hear little snippets of what their lives were like and what it was like for them traveling and playing music. And I think most importantly, more than the 10 minutes that I spent playing when I went to the open mic on Monday nights, was the 2 hours that I spent listening. Because I would hear 15 or 20 other people from all walks of life and all parts of the spectrum. I mean, still to this day at the Eddie's Attic open mic, you have professional musicians along with people who are giving their first public performance ever. And they're all performing together in the same 2-hour span. So for me as a kid to see all of that laid out before me, and to see it week after week, I was just getting so much inspiration and so many different examples of writing styles and of techniques and of performance tricks. And it just all kind of fed into making me, helping me develop what kind of performer I wanted to become.
And so what was your next step after that?
Well, I graduated high school early and went to college for audio engineering, of course. That's the obvious way to become a successful singer-songwriter.
Well, because actually then you've got, A, something else that you can do when you're not singing and songwriting, but B, you can always make sure you sound good.
That's true. You know, it's funny. I was, when I was in high school, there were a lot of, like, sort of what I would call, like, teeny bopper, bubblegum, you know, young teenage girls. And I realize now that I'm older that that's not a phenomenon that ever stops or starts. Mm-hmm. It's constant. But I was aware of it because I was in high school. And there were, you know, these young, really hip, popular, you know, radio-friendly girls. And I, having been just in my, like, poetry doesn't have mm-hmm. to rhyme phase, was really snide about that type of music. And I thought, well, I don't want to be that kind of overproduced pop starlet. That's terrible. And, you know, I was really pretty judgmental as a 15-year-old.
But that's part of being 15, you know.
Thank God.
Lighten up on yourself. That really is part of being 15.
Well, so I decided to go to college for audio engineering specifically because I did not want – I knew that I was going to become a recording artist and mm-hmm. a songwriter. Like, I had no doubt about that. But I didn't want to be vulnerable to evil producers in the studio who would manipulate my sound. And I wanted to be able to assert myself and, you know, ultimately use the production tools mm-hmm. as an extension of my creativity as well. So I went to college for audio engineering. But a funny thing happened while I was there, and I got completely sucked into it. I loved it. And I knew nothing about recording or engineering before I went to school. But I loved learning about the mixing board mm-hmm. and about all the different mics. And I would, you know, stay up late reading all the manuals and volunteer to assist other kids on their
wow.
projects. And I really dove in, and I really actually for several years in college abandoned my plans to become a performing musician.
What made you go back?
You know, right before I graduated, I was having a conversation with an engineering teacher of mine named Mark Wessel, who still teaches at Berkeley. He's a great guy. He was a big mentor of mine. And he had known all along that I played guitar and sang. I mm-hmm. didn't make a big deal out of it. I was pretty intimidated by all the other musicians at my college because they were all really good.
Because that is, for people that don't know, one of our premier, if not the premier, music school.
Yeah, it's
the Berklee College of Music.
Berklee College of Music. It's a great school, and I was really lucky to get mm-hmm. a fantastic education there. But I also was sort of the opposite of the kind of kid that I was in my house growing up, where I was always raising my hand and volunteering to sing. I kind of shrank back and let everybody else, you know, run to the forefront, and I would, you know, help with productions of other people and, you know, was always in the audience cheering. But I really focused more on audio engineering and on songwriting during my time at college. I was not trying to shine at all while I was there. I was kind of scared of the spotlight when I was in college. But I think that that helped me really focus on what I was trying to learn with the audio engineering stuff. So anyhow, right before I graduated, my teacher, Mark, who had known all along that I played guitar and sang and would even have me come to the engineering classes and play as the guinea pig.
Oh, I see. So while everybody else learned
teaching,
how to
yeah.
set things up. Okay.
Exactly. So while he was teaching engineering to other students, I'd just be sitting on a stool playing guitar and singing, which, by the way, also got me some early demos.
Ah, very clever.
Yeah, it was uh-huh. really more clever of him. Mm-hmm. I think he saw the big picture more than I did. But right before I graduated, we were talking about my future plans, and I told him that I was in love with audio engineering and I wanted to move to LA and get a job as an intern at a recording studio and maybe as a runner and then become an assistant and try mm-hmm. and work my way
right.
up. And maybe in 5 or 6 years, I could become an engineer. And I was, you know, laying out my plan, and he looked pretty somber, and he said, well, you know, Beck, you could do that, I'm sure, if you wanted to, but I just always thought you'd be happier doing something more creative. And that just floored me. It was like a bucket of cold water had been dumped over my head, and I snapped out of it, and I said, you're right, of course. And so I, you know, I graduated from school, and I did work for a little while as an engineer at a recording mm-hmm. studio, because that's what I'd been trained to do, and that helped me get some early recordings together that then became my first CD. But really, from the moment of that conversation, I just did a complete 180, and I came back out of my shell and resumed becoming the professional singer-songwriter that I knew I would be when I was a kid.
And does he now say, I told you so, every time a new record comes out?
He's a very gentle man. He would never say that.
Let's have another song, and then we'll talk
about
life after Berkeley.
You dropped in my hair for a minute. Now I am wallowing in it. The smell of your beard in the morning, your laugh in the dark. You feel like a house that I've lived in, that somebody else raised their kids in. Darling, what do you do to my heart? Swear it was fine when I made you, full of blood, a little sinew, nothing fancy, no, not working particularly hard. Next thing I knew, it was skipping out on the pond, skinny dipping, darling, what do you do? Not ideal, is it, baby? But I deal with it daily. I take out the trash, I water the yard from what I can tell. It was instant, an editorial misprint. So sorry, darling, what do you do to my heart? What did you do? What did you? What did you do? What did you do? What did you?
Rebecca Lobey's new CD is called Circus Heart, and we're hearing a couple of songs from that one today. Now, before that song, I sort of alluded to what was happening in your life right before you visited us the last time, which was you were in the first season of the worldwide smash, The Voice.
That is true.
You were the folk singer, were you not?
I was the token folk singer.
the token folk singer that seemed to take a lot of people by surprise because they didn't, I guess they didn't know that there were young female folk singers out there, did they?
No. You know, when I was in the casting process for the show doing the auditions prior to the blind audition, I was so stunned that I met so many people, you know, who worked for the casting department who didn't have any idea that there are people like me out there working and making a living performing original music.
And by that, I mean somebody that goes, like you said, 150, 200 days a year making a living for themselves.
Making a living playing.
Under the radar, sort of. But not really, because people that like that type of music know you're out there.
Yeah, there is an audience for it that they're also unaware of, I guess. But I feel like what they were unaware of is that there are people who make a living playing songs they write at shows that they book themselves and drive themselves to. You know, it's the minor league of music compared to the big, glossy, major you know, entertainment industry, but for me, it's where I like to be. It's a comfortable audience. It's a comfortable way to make a living. There's something really personal about the direct to fan interactions that I have.
And there are a lot of people that have made lifelong careers like that, like the guy that produced your record.
Exactly. Matt the Electrician.
Matt, who's been here a couple of times.
He's so good.
You know, Matt has a very happy family thanks to that life.
Exactly.
But let's get back to you and the voice. So somebody emailed you and said, we're starting up this TV show. Are you interested in auditioning? Is that how it happened?
That is exactly how it happened. And I thought, well, no, thank you. That doesn't sound good
no,
to me.
No, thank you. I've got my own business
going.
Yeah,
well, no, thank you. I'm busy touring all spring. Mm-hmm. I have lots of important shows that I can't possibly miss to be on your little TV show. You know, it was a totally unknown commodity. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Nobody had heard of it before. But they also inquired about several of my friends that were listed on my website. And I didn't want to blow off the opportunity for everybody. So
right.
I agreed to go to the audition. And some of my friends went and some of them passed. But it was really, you know, surprising. And I just felt from the moment that I went to my first audition that everything just flowed in the right direction.
Hmm.
You know, I walked in the door and I had a really good rapport with the people at the casting table. I was making jokes. I wore fancy high heels to the audition, but one of them broke while I was in line. So I walked in barefoot and said, I just want you to know I wore very fancy and uncomfortable shoes for you guys today, but they broke. So now I'm up here barefoot. And one of the guys said, what kind of shoes were they? And I said, well, cheap, apparently. And they were all just laughing. And it just became, you know, really comfortable for me.
Mm-hmm.
I think especially because I was so incredibly confident that there was no way they would pick a folk singer for a show like that. So I wasn't scared at all about whether or not I would make it onto
right,
the show.
And not intimidated
No, I just felt certain that I was there purely for fun and for the experience.
But, you know, it's funny. I have friends that are actors that have fallen into decent roles because of feeling that way in an audition. You know, I'm never going to get it, so I'm not nervous.
Exactly. Whatever you've got to do to psych yourself out.
It worked.
Yeah, it worked. No, and it also worked because it was season one. So mm-hmm. I didn't know that Christina Aguilera was going to be on the show. I didn't know that it was going to be aired in, you know, 100 countries all mm-hmm. over the world. I didn't know that it was going to be, you know, a big, giant, shiny, glossy, enormous production and a huge success. I was just auditioning at a tiny rehearsal space 2 miles from my house
right,
in Austin.
For some unknown show.
Yes.
I am talking with Rebecca Lobey about her newest CD, Circus Heart, and what it was like to be a part of the first series of the hit television show, The Voice. More music and conversation is coming up. I'm Catherine Cole. This is Roots and Branches on the VOA Music Mix Network. Thank you. Hello again from Washington. I'm Catherine Cole. This is Roots and Branches on VOA Music Mix. This hour, Rebecca Lobey is visiting in the Roots studio. Let's have another song and then dish a little bit more about the voice.
This is a song I wrote about a young man I met on an airplane. He was 18 years old and had never flown anywhere before. So I asked him why he was flying all the way from Miami to Chicago, and he told me he was flying to Chicago to get married.
Ooh.
And I said, oh, tell me everything about yourself. We talked the whole flight, and I went home and wrote a song about his story. This is called The Chicago Kid.
Well, I was born in South Florida and left there to die. I spent 18 long years in the weeds. I found it hard to believe in even changing a season. The leaves only turned on TV. And now I'll fly if I have to, though I would swim twice as long to be the one she'll press her back to. I am Chicago, going, gone. I showed her the stoplight my daddy must have fixed right before he left, a whisper in the wind. She kissed me like a church bell, Lord. She loved me like an anvil, and I haven't had her out of my mind since. And so my grandma told me that I've got his body, and I don't think she meant it unkind. But I'll keep punching these time cards and studying the fine art of working my way up in that girl's mind. And now I'll fly if I have to, though I would swim twice as long to be the one she'll press her back to. I am Chicago, going, gone. And one if by land, they say, two if by sea, three little words made a bird out of me. Well, I was born in South Florida and left this July. 18 years served me just fine. Now tell the boss I'm off to marry a sweet daughter of the prairie and a kissy where the sun'll never shine. And now I'll fly 'cause I have to, though I would swim twice as long to be the one she'll press her back to. I am Chicago, going, go. Yeah, I was born in South Florida, let me die in her arms. I'm Chicago, going, gone.
I am Catherine Cole. That's Rebecca Lobey on Roots and Branches. Before the break, Rebecca had started telling us about life on the first series of The Voice. So there you were. You were sent out to Los Angeles and sequestered, hidden away in a hotel room, not allowed to go out or even talk with your friends about what was happening.
For 6 weeks, I was out there. You know, it was season one, so they didn't know how long it was going to take to do anything.
Oh, really?
How long the audition, how long the executive auditions would take, how long the blind auditions would take, how long it would take to build new sets between the blind auditions and the battle rounds.
Oh, uh-huh.
They were still figuring out the formula. How many advisors were they going to have? How many days would the advisors be there? All that stuff. But they knew they wanted to get it on the air as quickly as possible. And so they kept us kind of waiting in this hotel while they figured all that stuff out, because that was the best way for them to most efficiently move forward as quick as possible, was just to have us on standby. And I think for future seasons, they've got it, you know, down to a science, and they're flying people back and forth as needed. But for us, we were just out there. So when I got the call that they wanted me to come audition for the network executives, they said, you know, we want you to come audition for network executives next weekend. You'll be out here for at least 3 days. And if that goes well, then we'll keep you for the blind auditions. And that'll be another 2 weeks. And if that goes well, we'll keep you out here for the battle rounds. And that'll take another 2 or maybe 3 weeks. So you'll be out here for at least 3 days, possibly up to 6 weeks. Pack accordingly.
Yeah. How do you do that?
I had a full tour schedule booked. So,
oh, no.
To be honest, I just packed for my tour and figured that I would cancel that first weekend's worth of shows, which were unfortunately here in the Maryland, Virginia, D.C. area. Sorry, everybody. And everybody was very, very understanding.
Of course.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and so I canceled that first weekend worth of shows. I went out there. I figured I would sing for the network TV executives. Mm-hmm. And they would say, who brought this folk singer here? Someone get a plane ticket back to the East Coast. So I just packed for my tour and figured I'd just hop right back out on the road. But I kept having to cancel shows, you know, a couple days at a time. Mm-hmm. Until finally, you know, next thing I knew, I was face-to-face with Christina Aguilera and Adam Levine, and I was on the show.
Now, were you surprised that they were the ones that expressed interest in you?
I was surprised that anyone expressed interest.
She's so modest.
I just truly didn't think I would end up in that position. And when I was going out there, I had just no expectation about anyone turning around. You know, they ask you, if all four coaches turn around, who would you choose? And, you know, I had said over and over that I would, if I had a choice, I would choose Adam, just because, you know, I admire his rock and roll lifestyle. You know, I could not have been more shocked when Christina Aguilera turned around first.
And what was her reasoning? I'm sure that she said it, and I can't remember.
She was so sweet. Oh, God, I'm speechless thinking about it. She was so incredibly supportive of what I had done with my performance, and she had so many nice things to say. She was really nurturing and kind. And, you know, I've thought about this a lot since that day. You know, I could have spent a long time debating that choice, but I only had about, you know, a minute and a half. If I didn't know anything about the two people and their careers, you know, what kind of music they make, I probably would have chosen to work with Christina just because
she was so nurturing.
She was so nurturing and so enthusiastic. She liked what I had done. And what I know about her now that I didn't know then is that she's really looking to use the voice to find people who do stuff that's completely different than what she does. But in that moment, all I knew is that her career to that point had been completely different than anything I aspired to in my own career. Whereas Adam's career still was different, but at least originated from a place of original songwriting and, you know, sort of, he's funk rock and I'm folk rock. So we kind of overlap there.
You've got the F's and you've got the R.
Got the F rock. So it just made more sense to me.
But it was a good experience.
It was wonderful.
Did you ever think, honestly, that you would be up there on national TV for weeks?
Nope.
and on iTunes all over the place. I mean,
yes.
What an audience you reached that would have taken you years.
Prior to being on The Voice, the biggest show I'd ever played really was, you know, a sold out CD release concert at Eddie's Attic, which is 180 people. And it was a big deal for me that I brought out that many ticket buyers in my own hometown. And that was a really joyful, triumphant night. But I could sell out Eddie's Attic 2 shows a night for the rest of my life and probably not sing to 12 million people, which is how many people saw me on The Voice. Now, bear in mind, I didn't do the math on that. I'm just guessing, but I think sounds about right.
Did you notice overseas interest from all that?
Yeah, that was a totally unforeseen bonus of the entire experience, is that since I was on season one of The Voice, it was the first English language version of the show. There had been one iteration of it previously in Holland, and that's where it became a big success. So they brought it to America and made a big scale US production of it. And then they played it all over the world. All over the world. And so every few weeks after the show had finished in the US, I'd get a little surge of Twitter and Facebook and email attention from people who were just seeing it in their home country for the first time. And I think it's because it was season one of the show and they were trying to launch the franchise all over the world. So they used the first US, you know, English language version of it to show it in other countries to see what the interest was.
Have you taken advantage of that to travel and play overseas?
I am definitely interested in traveling overseas. I'm working on a tour in Europe and I'm hoping to go to South America. I've gotten a lot of enthusiasm from a bunch of fans in Brazil.
Great.
You know, and I only know that because I'm pretty active on Twitter, but I can just sort of tell from my Twitter stream and from the people who send me personal messages and from Facebook, actually, that I've just been getting a lot of Brazilian attention, but, and I'd like to take advantage of that.
Why not? And Australia, I'm sure, will be following at some point.
Yes. Oh, God, I would absolutely love to go down there. And for me, I have my hands full just trying to get my U.S. career together. So for things like that, I need to sort of be networking and meeting people who know what doors to open. Because I've spent 5 years now doing music full time in the U.S. and it's all been very trial and error. But I need to find people who have already done the trial and error in different markets to kind of help me.
Well, it's interesting. John Arthur Martinez, who did the first season of the Country Idol show. And Nashville Star, I guess, has been in a couple of times. And he told me that he five or six or how many years later now, still has regular tours through Western Europe and other places based on what you're talking about. The first run version of the show aired many, many times over there.
Well, that's good to know.
Thank you. Yes, there's hope. In fact, you should. He lives not too far from you in Texas.
Really?
He's in Marble Falls.
Cool. I'll have to get his information from you.
Absolutely. He's paved the way for you. Let's have another song.
All right.
Rebecca's new CD is called Circus Heart, CD number 3. First, Post the Voice.
I have traveled many fathoms, lived inside a covered wagon, sold my secrets wholesale every night. I've broken bread with petty tyrants, smuggled wine to fallen giants. Right before your eyes, and now I try oceanside to govern the rolling tide. Swallowed by the sea, beckoned from the shore, tempted by the sweet. Graces, counted cards and covered bases, made believe till I was making do. Now where do I draw the line between vittles and valentines? Swallowed by the sea, beckoned from the shore, by the sweet river. I don't want to be hungry anymore, but it's getting harder to ignore. Baby, don't let me be swallowed by the sea. My heart like holy tarot. Hold on, baby, please don't let me be swallowed by the sea, begging from the shore, tempted by the sweet.
Swallowed by the Sea. That is from Rebecca Lobey's new CD, which is called Circus Heart. And that one, according to the note that I have, it was sort of spawned by that whole voice extravaganza.
Exactly. I started that song, the very first line of it, the day that I auditioned for the show in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
When I had, you know, my first series of conversation with the casting directors of the show, and it became apparent that they were unaware that there was this burgeoning indie folk scene in the country, and that
Surprise!
There are thousands of people who make a living playing original music at gigs they book and drive themselves to. And for me, I was just shocked that they didn't know that there are so many people doing it. So I figured, you know, I just went home and the words just started spilling out of me. I have traveled many fathoms, lived inside a covered wagon, sold my secrets, you know. Just, I wanted to write a fable about what it's like to be a touring folk singer, to try and bring them some understanding of my lifestyle.
And did it seem to sink in at all?
I think that's a good question, actually.
Probably not, but who knows? I mean, maybe by now they get it.
I think you were a trailblazer.
Well,
something I've been very impressed with by the show in seasons one and two is that in their casting, they are bringing in a lot of hardworking
real musicians,
mm-hmm. people who have had careers, who have been building it on their own for years and years. A lot of singer-songwriters in season two, and you know, even several others in season one. And for me, it means a lot to me that they're creating a platform for people who have been working hard. They're not trying to claim that they're plucking people out of obscurity. You know, they're just saying we're looking for the best voice in the country, and they don't care where it comes from or what kind of career it's already had.
So you went through the whole show process, and you were there for a couple of weeks, and then you had to go out and start working again.
Yeah, I was actually out there for 6 weeks.
You were off the road for 6 weeks,
yes.
Which is not a usual thing for you.
No.
That must have actually kind of been luxurious. I mean, you could write.
Well, in some ways it was luxurious. Here's an example. I had just been to the Folk Alliance Conference in Memphis, Tennessee, a month before, and I had stayed in a hotel room for 4 days with five of my songwriter friends, and we slept six deep in a room with, you know, two double beds and a couple of cots and some sleeping bags. And when I went out for the casting, I stayed at a Marriott hotel, same exact floor plan as the hotel in Memphis, and I got the whole room all to myself.
Oh.
And I thought, man, I could get used to this.
You not only had the whole room to yourself, you had the whole bathroom to yourself,
yes,
right?
You didn't have to wait.
You didn't have to wait for six other people to cycle
through. So that was, you know, definitely one of the benefits.
And you weren't driving 200 miles a day.
No, I wasn't. But what I gained in sort of luxury, I think that I paid for in control. Because I am basically self-employed. I work for Rebecca Lobey Enterprises, and I am Rebecca Lobey, so I'm in charge. I'm the only employee and the boss. As a participant in this TV show, I found that there were a lot of other people in charge, and I was not one of them. And there were, you know, rules, and, you know, they had invested money in us, and so they wanted to make sure that we stayed safe and kept quiet. So we were truly sequestered in the hotel. There were periods where we weren't really allowed to leave our rooms without checking in and telling them where we were going to be.
Interesting.
And at no point did I have any idea when anything was going to happen. You know, I was out there for 6 weeks, but I didn't go into it knowing, like, all right, well, on Monday I'm going to have these meetings, and on Tuesday there's a rehearsal, and on Friday there's a performance. Every morning I woke up feeling like there was a piano about to fall on my head. You know, that at any minute I would get a call saying, be hair and makeup ready in the lobby in 2 hours or an hour. And then I would get whisked away to, I don't know what, a rehearsal, a taping, a performance. And for me, just that was very anxiety producing. And it, you know, I tried to use it as an opportunity to learn patience and to let go of some of my
That's looking
control.
At the bright side.
I am nothing if not the one that looks at the bright side. My dad actually calls me Pollyanna.
Funny. That's what my family, I was the Pollyanna of my family too.
Yeah, the glad game.
Yes. So I guess that meant you also didn't have control about how you looked.
No.
Did they have an idea of what they wanted Rebecca Lobey to look like?
No, they really didn't. Some people had a more firm style identity for themselves, and I don't really have that. I'm a jeans and t-shirt girl. I try to get dressed up when I play gigs, but I go through phases with what I wear. I don't really have a strong sense of fashion. I don't care that much.
Right. You have other things taking up space in your head.
Exactly. I have other things taking up space in my head. And I think that that actually made it harder for the wardrobe people, especially because in the beginning of the show, they were trying to find performance outfits for 64 people. So if I had gone in there and said, I only wear the color blue and I like to have flowers in my hair,
you know,
like that would have given them something to work with. But instead I was like, I just don't want to look dumb,
you know?
And it's not as helpful to them. You know, I didn't have a strong personality. So they, you know, they would go shopping because I wasn't allowed to leave. I wasn't allowed to go shopping. And they actually wanted us to wear our own clothes for the audition. But there were certain rules about what clothes could go on the air. No small patterns, no logos.
Oh, right. Yes.
And my clothes, this sounds really pathetic, but my clothes would have like, you know, small patches that were unraveling and little holes and stuff that I think are just character, but apparently NBC didn't want on the airwaves. So they had to get new clothes for me. And I had a little bit of wiggle room. I had a little bit of veto power. But honestly, something I found through the whole process is that I did not really feel like I had the right to assert myself too much because I felt like at any minute I might get sent home. I didn't want to get sent home because I gave the wardrobe people trouble.
Right,
you know?
Right. If you're going to be sent home, be sent home for a reason.
Yeah.
Not just that.
Be sent home for a steamy sex scandal.
Right, or something.
By golly.
Which there wasn't.
No.
But
Darn it.
You were sent home. And so that was that a relief? Because, I mean, it could be life as usual again.
You know,
I mean, a little bittersweet because you always want to win.
It was definitely bittersweet. But, you know, I am happy to have lost in the way that I lost.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, for... If you're not familiar with the show, they do the second phase of competition on the show. They pair people up who are on the same team and they have them sing a duet. And then at the end of the duet, they pick a winner, which I think is weird.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think that music is made to be a competition like that. And I know that a lot of the pairs didn't really speak to one another. They didn't really rehearse together that much. You know,
They
saw each other as enemies and they really just worked separately on their performances.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even think about doing it. Like, I didn't know that that's what other people were doing.
Right.
And it just didn't occur to me to approach it that way.
Was a real duet.
You know, I perform with other musicians constantly on the road. I rely on other musicians on the road. And I felt like if I was going to get up on national TV and sing a song with another person, I wanted it to be the best performance we could give. So we rehearsed together for hours and hours a day and got to know each other. And it was a really positive experience. And by the end of it, I really felt like I would be happy with whatever the outcome was. It was, you know, looking at the bright side again, it was like, yes, I would have loved to win and, you know, be rewarded with that and move on. But I would have been really sad if Devin had lost because he worked very hard, just as hard as I did. And, you know, I was really happy to see him get rewarded for his hard work because he didn't know the song at all when we got started. He felt really uncomfortable about the song choice and he just shone. He did a great job.
Well, that means that you're kind of a good producer too.
I don't want to take any of his credit. He did a really good job.
But now, you know, we'll go back to that. I mentioned producer again. We mentioned Matt for a second. What made you decide that you wanted to work with Matt Seaver, Matt the Electrician, on this new record?
I love Matt the Electrician.
Oh, who doesn't?
I just, if anybody listening doesn't know who I'm talking about, stop listening to this. Go to iTunes and look up Matt the Electrician. You will fall in love. He's amazing. Mm-hmm. And since I met him at Folk Alliance in 2010, we've been developing a friendship and he, you know, I have all of his records and his album Animal Boy came out in 2010 at the very same time as my CD Mystery Prize. And they were both on the radio at the same time and on the Americana charts at the same time. So I was seeing his name a lot. And when I got my hands on that album, I would say that I have listened to that record, Animal Boy, more than any other single album in the last 2 years.
Really?
It just really speaks to me. And I love everything about it. I love the songwriting, but I also love the instrumental choices, the production choices, the way it's laid out sonically.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's brilliant. And I was so impressed when I learned that he produced it himself. He works with an engineer in Austin named Mark Addison, who's also got a lot to contribute production-wise and instrumentally. And they kind of work as a team. So when I was getting ready to record my most recent album and I was thinking about what characteristics I wanted it to have and who I might be able to work with as a partner, I thought, well, you know, if I could get anyone, I would just get Matt the Electrician to do it. But he's always on tour. He probably isn't available. And so I asked him out for breakfast tacos, which is a very Austin thing to do on a Friday morning. We got together for coffee and breakfast tacos. And, you know, I told him that I was looking for a producer and what my time frame was. And, you know, he's so sweet and humble. And he starts helping me brainstorm producers in Austin that I could ask. And finally, I just blurted it out. And I said, well, if I could work with anyone, I'd love to work with you. and I could see the gears turning in his head. And what I didn't realize at that point is that he had never produced anything for anyone else besides his own albums, which is shocking to me because he's so good at it. So anyhow, he gave it some thought. I sent him some demos. He talked it over with his wife. We had some really long conversations about what we like about music and about a good album and what we would want to try and create. And then we decided to work together and we went for it. And it was glorious. It was so much fun.
So you could have started him off on a whole new career path.
Hopefully so. He's really great at it. You know, it was so funny because he's got two young kids and I love his children. And there would be times when I would be in the vocal booth and I would be, you know, singing background vocals or, you know, doing whatever I was doing. And I would be exhausted from a long day and not getting this one part. And he'd come in and he'd say, "Well, Rebecca, let's talk this one through." And he would be like, dad me. He would use his dad skills.
I love it.
To like calm me down and get me to approach it from a different angle. And I loved it. Just nurture me, Matt. Nurture me. I need it.
Would like to learn more about Rebecca Lobey, find out what she's up to this month, where she's going next, and hear more music, it's very easy. She is all over the web. Start at RebeccaLobey.com. That is RebeccaLobey.com. And that'll direct you to her Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, all kinds of stuff. Don't forget, my email is roots@voa.gov. That is roots@voa.gov. You can find me on Twitter, too, Catherine Cole, KatherineCole. And do a search for our new VOA music blogs and take a look. You're listening to Roots and Branches on the VOA Music Mix Network.